3, 2, 1.
The History with Jackson podcast.
So hello and welcome back to the History of Jackson podcast, the podcast where we bring up-to-date historical research to you in an accessible and digestible way. So today we welcome back author, historian and great friend of the podcast, Steve Tibble. How are you doing, Steve?
Oh, very well, Jackson. Always a pleasure to be with you. And you're looking very, very good this afternoon, as I can see.
Oh, and you're looking equally as healthy. So I'm excited to discuss this. Yeah. So this is part two of a series of two episodes that we're doing recently on your set of books, Crusader Armies. But today we're discussing the Crusader strategy, defending the Holy Land. Now, this is equally as good as the other two books that we've discussed, which are some among my books of the year. And as always, I want to ask you, what inspired you to write the Crusader strategy?
Yeah, thank you. Oh, well, that's a really good question. I mean, in a way, it's a funny title. You know, it sounds a bit like a contradiction in terms, you know, because I was brought up with the medieval school of Monty Python, you know, and the Holy Grail. And it's like, well, I didn't vote for you kind of thing. You know, medieval, the idea that medieval people had strategy or had, you know, intellectual skills was always ridiculed when I was growing up. And I guess I slightly rebelled against that. And I always felt that we were doing them a disservice and that medieval people were no more stupid or no more clever than we are. But in a way, we have this kind of lazy, patronizing view of them because we think we're so clever because we've got, you know, we've got the internet, we've got laptops. You know, I'm talking to you on a lovely, you know, Zoom link here, which all looks very good. And, you know, those guys didn't wash. They didn't have many resources. So there's this patronizing approach where you think, okay, well, you know, I must be cleverer than them. And I think it's exactly the opposite, actually, that to be a person who wakes up in the morning with nothing and has to effectively almost recreate your world and try and do great things with nothing must mean that you're a more resourceful person and you have to work harder with what you've got. So this book was about my frustration, I guess, and yeah, it's a bit of an homage of respect to people who I could see in the history books are doing very impressive things. You don't have to agree with what they're doing, but you can see within the confines of what they've got available, they're doing marvelous things. So it's my little way of trying to redress the balance, looking at what they did and then saying, okay, you know, maybe they weren't so stupid. Let's have a look at the reality of what they did and let's not be patronizing.
I love that you're trying to correct those misconceptions that we have about the period. And as you said, it's miraculous how some of these people were able to get on with their life in the face of such tremendous adversity, almost on a daily basis. But the key word, as I said last episode, the key word in that title was armies. The key word in this title is strategy. So what do you mean by the term strategy?
Yeah, strategy is very misused as a word in the modern world. And you can see when governments decide to do things or PR companies start talking or ad campaigns start running, people bandy the word strategy around. And they often don't know what they're talking about. And it's a kind of mask to put a carapace over often very flimsy thinking and very lazy thinking. In reality, often people say, oh, well, this is a strategic idea, or, you know, I've got a strategic quest or whatever. And you know, a strategic quest is an objective. It's not a strategy. And, you know, I've got a strategic idea normally just means, oh, I've got a big idea or an idea that I think is big. And, you know, none of that is strategy. So, obviously there's a lot of technical language around that. And a lot of books written about the nature of strategy. And the way I'm using it, and I think is a moderately helpful way of doing it, is to look at military decision making on different levels. And I guess at the top level you have policy. So this is people at the top deciding what you want to do. So effectively that would be objectives. And that objective might be to, you know, to capture Damascus or to fend off an invasion or whatever. And then strategy within that would be, is the how. you know, how do we capture Damascus? How do we fend off an invasion? And then underneath strategy, you have two other levels, operational, which would be things like how you muster the troops, how you manage your longer-term logistics supplies and so on, those kind of things that sit somewhere between strategy and the battlefield itself. And then underneath operational stuff, you have tactics. And tactics, to me, are what happen on the battlefield. It's what happens in a siege. It's whether you decide to use the catapult rather than the siege tower, or whether you decide to use a charge rather than archery. You know, those kind of things. So it's really four levels. Policy, which is objectives. Strategy, which is how we achieve those objectives. Operational, which is putting that strategy into place. And then tactics, which is how this all works on the battlefield. So that's, to me, is a quite clear distinction in my mind between those four elements. And what we're talking about today is really the second of those two, which is that much misused word strategy. And it's basically how, in the context of what we're talking about today, is how the Crusaders developed the how. You know, what were their plans to do the things they needed to do? But also, I think back to the very first question you quite rightly asked was, you know, as in what started all this? And that is, you know, did they actually have a strategy? Well, you know, how could they come up with a strategy when they didn't have the vocabulary to talk about it? You know, and there'll be some people, real purists, who would say, well, strategy was kind of reinvented in the 18th century. You know, there's not much you can talk about strategy between Rome and you know, Frederick the Great. I actually think, I mean, that may be true on a very kind of pedantic technical level, but if you look at what people do, you can see with the Crusaders, you know, which is the one I know about, that they are enacting strategy. They just don't have, you know, they don't have emails. They don't have sort of proper formatting of documents that you can look and say, oh, well, here's strategy version 3. But you can see that they are actually enacting it. And that was the thing I really enjoyed about this book was, it was almost the process. You know, in modern times, you could look at a strategy and then see how it played out. In medieval times, because they don't have the vocabulary, you have to see how it played out and then deconstruct that to see what the strategy was. And it's a lovely process. It's a very fun thing to do. Because you can go through the chronicles, and the guys writing the chronicles don't necessarily know the strategy either. In fact, most times they don't. But you can see from what the main players are doing that there is a strategic intent. And it's that beautiful thing is you can rewrite the narrative once you understand what all the actions are doing. And from a chronicler's perspective, you know, they love to talk about things happening, you know, so this king does that, this one gets married, that one drops dead, you know, falls off a cliff or whatever. And so it reads like a newspaper stroke soap opera. But if you take all those actions and carefully analyze what's happening and then step back, you can see, wow, okay, in many cases, this clearly is part of a long-term, well-thought-through strategy. And the more I did that, the more impressed I was with the guys when you can see what they're up to. And that applies to the Crusaders, but also their enemies and their partners. These are not, you know, all of the players in the region are not stupid people. And I found it quite refreshing to see that, you know, our ancestors weren't as stupid as we thought they were. They were actually very resourceful people.
It's really interesting to see how there is a multi-layered approach by working backwards, but also how, and I like the fact that you acknowledge that there's other parties within the Crusades who are taking part or assisting these Crusader states. But that other party point can be quite difficult for us. And the idea that there's a misconception that there's a homogenous Crusader state when there's not, there's several states within that. So how do all these different territories and all these different relationships affect the how, affect the strategy?
Yeah. I mean, Ben, as now, you know, life is complicated and you can never, you know, we like making generalizations, but we all know that life on the ground isn't like that. So you're absolutely right. The Crusader states, you know, there's an S at the end of the word state. And, you know, so there were four basic states to start off with, quickly came down to three when the county of Edessa was overrun. But each of those is a different political entity. And we all know human beings being, you know, the little scamps that they are, the people have different interests. So although we might think of the Crusaders as having fully aligned interests, in reality, you know, that's true sometimes. But other times, you know, people just don't like each other, or, you know, I'm the King of Jerusalem. I mean, I want the Crusader states and the Christian Middle East to do well, presumably. But ultimately, my job is to look after the people of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. So, you know, there's always a tension between those two, you know, the different political bodies. And you find that just as much, probably even more, actually, on the Islamic side, because particularly when the Crusaders arrived. One of the reasons why the Crusaders did so well in the early years was because they're wasn't because of their inherent strengths. It was more actually that their enemies were very disunited. You know, and every city had a different Turkic leader, and he was probably more worried about his fellow Turks in the next city than he was worried about the Crusaders, because didn't really know much about them. But he knew the guys in the next city were going to be a real nuisance if they got in. So it's always multi-layered. And even within the Crusader states, I mean, this is something we might talk about later, but it's not a homogenous group of people. You know, within every Crusader state, there's a Muslim minority. Most of the natives are Christians, but there would be Christian Arabs, or they might be Christian Armenians or Christian Syrians, and they'll be of different denominations. And then you get Italians and French, and, you know, it's always more like a group discussion. You know, if you think, for my sins, I had a couple of years in market research, and I think medieval strategy is much more about convening a sort of market research focus group, because you're always trying to get all these different interest groups to agree. Because, you know, for instance, the kings of Jerusalem, they would have loved to be dictators. And when I was a kid, I always assumed kings were dictators and they said what they wanted and everybody jumped around and did it. And, you know, the more you know about it, the more you know that's not true. You have to bring everybody with you. You have to persuade people. And, you know, sometimes you have to make enemies even amongst your own people to try and get things to happen. It's always complicated. But that's part of what I love about these guys, is they still... And this is true of all of them, Crusaders, Islamic States, Byzantines, whatever. Everybody is working hard under really difficult circumstances to try and make things happen. And I'm always amazed how well they did under the circumstances, how people did actually have very vibrant, very insightful strategies. And they did a lot to try and put them into action.
It's, like we said earlier, it's almost a daily struggle, either against the other side, the Islamic side, even though we discussed last episode that it's not purely Islamic, and then your other Crusader states as well. Everyone's out for themselves, really, very often similar to what it was like in Europe at the point. But there's also another area of the Crusader states, which I don't think we discuss an awful lot, and you discuss at length within your book, is the sea. And I think a lot of us tend to ignore the sea, but it is the main way to get there, and it is the main way to get things in and out of there. So how does it play into the strategy, but also how does it create a reliance for the Crusader states on other parties?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I was, when I first started looking at the strategy of the Crusader states, I mean, the temptation is to get very, very complicated and try and say clever things, which obviously I failed to do, but... As soon as you start looking at what is the real primal grounding of the Crusader states, you realize it's the sea. And actually, the clue, the huge elephant in the room that's actually facing you the whole time, is we call them the Crusader states, but that's not what they called themselves or what people in Europe called them. They called them Outremer, the people across the sea. And that is... That is the answer. That is the key to unlocking the whole of that initial primary strategy. So the first crusade arrives. They do, you know, surprisingly well, largely because their enemies are fragmented. But then most of the guys go home. So you've got this kind of surprising, shocking situation where the Christians are temporarily back in control of most of the Holy Land, but with almost nobody to defend these things that they've recaptured. So what do you do about that? How do you make the Crusader states last longer than, you know, 2 or 3 months. I mean, basically, if they didn't have help from Europe, probably what would have happened is their life expectancy would have been the same as the length of time it took their enemies to stop squabbling and just muster armies. So it could have been a matter of months. You know, if everybody had been united on the enemy front, could have been a long weekend. You know, these are not big countries. They're, you know, 2 or 3 days campaigning for an enemy cavalry army. Europe is the key. And I think everybody realized this really quickly. And again, hats off to them, because, you know, as a kid, it took me years to get my head around it, but they must have realized it instantly. You know, they capture. So you find that there's this initial strategy of rolling up the coast, because the coast, when the Crusaders arrive, is mostly certainly around in the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem and the county of Tripoli are city-states that are pretty much run as part of the Fatimid Empire. So they're part of the Egyptian Empire. And then further north, you get different levels of ownership. But those ports absolutely are a kind of noose around the neck of the Crusader states. If, you know, because, okay, the Crusaders have 1 or 2 ports when they arrive, but with the Egyptian Navy, the Egyptians have a very impressive regular navy, and they can intercept shipping coming in. They can kill and enslave any pilgrims who are trying to get out there. They can stop supplies coming through. And ultimately, it's, you know, the bloodline back to Europe. Their people need warm bodies to defend the Holy Land. And if people can't get there, then they can't do it. So the Crusaders put this very clear, very concerted strategy into action, where they just rolled up each of the Fatimid ports as they went up the coast of the Holy Land, and incredibly effective in doing so. And it's one of those things where you read the Chronicles, it's the perfect example of what we were talking about earlier, where if you read the Chronicles, it's like, you know, Hello Magazine or whatever. It's just a series of actions, one after another. But then when you look at the stray comments, you realize, okay, there's an Italian fleet turns up, and everybody starts saying, oh, yes, well, the Italian fleet was turned up, and what a lucky chance that was. But then you occasionally come across a legal document, and you realize, oh, okay, so embassies, diplomats have been going over to Italy for 5 years now, trying to make sure this happens. You know, so the Chronicles portray it as the will of God, or, you know, some lucky chance that this Italian fleet happened to be in the area at the time. And in fact, it was nothing like that at all. You can trace back where legal records exist. You can trace back a whole long planning process where the kings of Jerusalem are permanently pumping out letters, you know, begging letters to the West, saying, come on, lads, you know, come on, help us. We're dead in the water here. And, you know, we need you to come quickly. So all of these cities on the coast that are rolled up are by and large rolled up with help from Europe, because the Crusaders are kind of tiny in number, and they never have a fleet. So you can imagine it, you can't really besiege a coastal city easily unless you can blockade them by sea as well as on land. And so all of these things that look like coincidences, or, you know, a happy chance that the Genoese fleet happened to be on holiday that year and happened to be pulling into Tyre up for their holiday plans. You know, none of that is true. It actually is all incredibly planned and very, very strategically thought through.
I think that's the interesting thing about Chronicles, is they don't have the full picture, but when you put them together with other documents, you're able to understand a bit more. But you're bringing in the Italians there, the Genoese, and there's even the Venetians. How vital are the Italians, the Venetians, the Genoese in executing the how for the Crusaders?
I think it's hard to overestimate, actually. And they're less romantic. You know, we always think of the Crusaders as being, whether you like them or not, so, you know, slightly colourful, glamorous figures doing crazy things on horseback, you know, knights charging and everything. What you don't think of is, you know, Italian engineers, Italian carpenters. I mean, the real nitty-gritty of maritime shipping and siegecraft. But those skills were what really won the battle for all the coastal cities. So, there are some sieges where, reading between the lines, you know, if you actually analyze the data bearing all this in mind, you can see the Italians are actually really doing all the heavy lifting. So you get an Italian fleet pulls in, and that's fine. And then the siege engines are built. So you think, okay, how's that happening? And then you find a stray comment saying, oh, it was Italian carpenters bringing Italian wood over. Because actually wood for siege engines is in very short supply in the Middle East, because you need these very long beams to do these things. And then places like Caesarea, the siege of Caesarea, you find that there are, you know, siege troops going up, they're on the walls, and they're, you know, assault parties doing great things. And actually then somebody by a stray remark, you think, oh, okay, that's one of the Venetian consuls leading that assault party, which means they're all Venetian troops charging over a wall with supporting fire from Venetian catapults with wood provided by the Venetian fleet in a naval blockade provided by, you know, the Venetian Navy. I think it's hard to overestimate the impact they had. And the other thing that's hard to overestimate is how different the Crusades would have been if that hadn't happened. You know, literally, I think the Crusades could have just finished within a year or two, because the guys, without help from the West, they've got nowhere to go. They're just this tiny little strip of land on the edge of a huge Islamic empire. And it's only these kind of sea lanes to the West that make Outremer a going concern for any period of time at all.
I think, as you said in your book, I think a lot of historians and a lot of casual people who are interested in history get blinded by these big crusading celebrities. You know, Prince Edward, King Edward going over there and looking like the hero. But there's so many other players and parties who have got those understated roles that it's important not to ignore.
You're 100% right. And I think the Italians particularly get a rough deal because they're seen quite rightly as being commercial, you know, so they're unromantic in the sense that they're after a bit of cash. Whereas you could portray all the, you know, the other crusaders as pious people doing selfless work for God. But in reality, you know, human beings are complex creatures, you know, and these, it's quite possible to be commercial and pious at the same time. And I think it's pretty clear that the Italians were both. So they wanted a good deal. They wanted commercial rights. You know, they weren't there because they were Mother Teresa, they were there because they wanted to, you know, further their own interests. But it doesn't mean they're not devout as well. And you do find this with these Italian crusaders. They're coming over and you think, you know, oh really? Okay, well, it's a commercial exercise for them, which it's true. But then, you know, before you quite often find, before they start fighting, they instantly go off and spend a week going to the holy places. They'll trade plunder rights for, you know, a single cup that they may think was the Holy Grail, and so on. So they're hard-nosed up to a point, but then they're just like everybody else as well. But because they have this unglamorous, you know, slightly commercial tinge to them, they get written out of the story, because I think particularly, say, for Victorians, you know, they wanted to see their heroes. And the same in even the medieval chroniclers, they want their heroes to be, you know, posh people doing posh things on the back of a horse. But that's not how medieval warfare always worked.
It's probably tainted by the fact that the Italians were a little bit more honest about what they wanted out of it than some of these kings going over and go, oh, I'm going to crusade and pilgrimage, or I'm going over there to improve my military skills.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And, or, you know, we all have a range of different motives for everything we do. It's very hard to deconstruct all these things. But I think the biggest mistake you can make is to assume that people only have one motive, you know, that we're capable of operating on only one motive. And people aren't like that. We're Venn diagrams, just moving around doing crazy things.
That's a lovely point. I like that. I like that a lot. Now, the sea is one fringe of the Crusader state, but there is the rest of this land that is on the fringe. How does defending the Crusader states and the strategy and the how around how to defend, how to attack from the interior and the exterior differ?
Yeah. In a way, that the coastal strategy is nice from a historian's point of view, because it's quite, you get a lot of clarity. You know, it's pretty binary. You can just see what's happening and it plays out in front of you. The bigger problem, I guess, is holding the, you know, the land inside, you know, because the Crusaders, with the exception of a couple of cities, don't have large population centers. And you've got these large population centers on the interior that dominate large areas of land, places like Damascus and Aleppo and so on. And they used to be Christian before the Muslim invasions of the 7th century and then again 11th century. So there are, you know, significant Christian populations in those areas, but they're the period we're talking about, they're mostly run by Turkic warlords. So the Crusaders actually did develop very sophisticated, very intelligent strategies to try and capture some of those cities, because if you can capture a big population center, then you control lots of land, and then medieval armies, you know, they live on fiefs, so you can then send letters back to Europe saying, come on lads, you know, we got loads of land here, come along, come and defend us. And you can actually create a defense in depth, but you change the demographics, so you have a large enough population base where you can defend yourself. So there was a lot of strategy around capturing places like Shazar and Aleppo and Damascus. The one thing I would stress, though, is that when we talk about strategy, we often think, oh, strategy, that means success. But actually, you can have a strategy that fails. It's like you can have, and that's the thing that struck me all the way through writing the book, is it's fine having a good strategy and a strategy that looks good, but actually having the resources to pull it through is a different matter. So one thing that you can see when you're looking at what the Crusaders are doing here is they have you have to admire them for their kind of chutzpah in all this. I mean, they're superbly confident, probably overconfident, really, partly because they don't realize how lucky they were, you know, when they first arrived, that they came into an environment where their enemies were fragmented. But if you understand anything about, you know, Google Maps or demography, or you can just see they're on a hiding to nothing because they're so outnumbered. So a lot of their strategies effectively either end in failure or are defensive strategies to delay failure, because there aren't any better options. You know, particularly the strategy that I think you alluded to there in terms of the, you know, the hinterland, trying to recapture some of the Christian hinterland of the Middle East. They put very elaborate plans into place, and they did everything they could to get allies like the Byzantines or the King of France or whatever to send over troops. And they spent a lot of time on diplomacy and training and deploying new different tactics. But ultimately, if you haven't got enough men, if you haven't got the boots on the ground, it's always difficult to pull off. And they kind of got close to it a couple of times, but they never managed to capture a major population center other than the ones on the coast. And, you know, as we've seen, capturing the ones on the coast was largely down to, you know, their Italian friends coming to help out for commercial and as well as piety reasons.
I think it shows the difficulties of being an occupying force within a land that you're not used to, surrounded by enemies you don't really know. It demonstrates the difficulties in that.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, they weren't an occupying force in the sense that, you know, the local peasantry all hated them and they were about to go into an uprising, because what we tend to forget is that most of the population was still Christian in those days. So the trouble was they were largely local Christian Arabs who had been demilitarized. You know, as far back as the Roman days, the Roman army never encouraged, you know, the locals to have a lot of weapons training. And so the whole area had been fairly demilitarized. So it was more difficult to recruit local troops, but there weren't that many of them compared to, you know, the groups that surrounded them. So it was very difficult to ever avoid being outnumbered. And that forces you to take strategic risks. And again, I think that's one theme that you see over and over again, is the Crusaders do bold things. And because I'm not a very bold person, I'm very, you know, I lead a very simple life, and you know, I don't do any, you know, big adventures. I always admire them because they are bold and they do adventurous things. But equally, they did it because they had to. You know, they didn't have a lot of choices. You needed to throw the dice and get a six, you know, to have a chance of winning. And so that's what they did. It didn't mean that they were going to win, but it was the best of a bad bunch of decisions, and they did the best they could to last as long as they could. You know, and actually they lasted nearly 200 years. Whereas if you were to take a look at the Crusades in 1099, you'd say, how long have these people got to live? Well, it's like, you know, are they going to get Christmas presents? You know, it's you'd think they don't have a big life expectancy, but they did. They managed to drag it out for 200 years, which actually on one level, you know, you have to admire them. But on the other hand, that's the sadness of the Crusades. It's like so many wars, you know, if you're going to lose, best thing you can do is lose quickly. So you don't drag out the pain. And the Crusades, really, the story of the Crusades is 200 years of pain for all the parties that was dragged out by the bravery of, you know, everybody on all different sides.
Certainly dancing on that knife edge for a very, very long time. But there's something you mentioned there about strategy and having to roll those sixes quite a lot. The kings of Jerusalem and the nobility in that area, they clearly have an understanding of when they can try and go for a six and when they're going to get a one. So they're very clear on when they can take those risks and when they can't. But when Europeans come over, you know, with their big armies and their idea of warfare, how many issues does that create for the strategic thinking of the area? Because you've got Europeans who just don't know the political situation. They don't know the capability of the enemy. They don't know the terrain. So how does that affect the how?
Yeah, it's central. Actually, that's a very, very good point. So the Crusader states need help from Western Europe. They need the motherland to, you know, keep pumping resources out to the east. So they're right to ask for it, and they go to great lengths to try and get it. I mean, the kings of Jerusalem are often, it's embarrassing reading their letters sometimes. They're so obsequious, you know, when they're writing, say, the king of France for help. It's, you know, they're almost literally bending over backwards, you know, saying, you know, you can have whatever you want if you come out here. And they're not wrong to do that, because that's the only way they're going to get help. The trouble is, when the Westerners arrive, it's a fairly alien world to them. They certainly don't understand the nuances of the power play and the diplomatics of life in the East. And some of them don't even know about the tactics. You know, they're dealing with a very different style of warfare. And that always creates tensions, because a lot of the guys in the Crusader states are not... it's one of the other unspoken things, is they're not all white men. You know, these are basically most of the so-called Crusaders in the Holy Land will have been at least partly Arabs by this point. Even the kings of Jerusalem were, multi-ethnic, and there'd been, you know, a heritage of marrying some of the local Christians. So there's this kind of unspoken thing about suspicion between the Westerners and the Easterners. You know, they come out and these people look slightly different, and okay, they're all Christians, but they're still a bit alien, and there is this kind of prejudice that, or perhaps they're a little bit softer because, you know, effeminate, because they don't want to just charge anything that appears in front of them. And the reason they don't want to charge everything that appears in front of them is because they're good soldiers, and they know the dangers of doing that, and they know that they've got to kind of marshal their resources for a long fight. Whereas if you're a crusader coming over, you're basically a tourist, you know, so you're there, like, you know, we might go on a two-week holiday and act in a slightly more abandoned and relaxed way because we know we're going home in 2 weeks. And it's a similar kind of mindset for some of the crusaders. You know, they're there to do exciting, brave things for a short while, leave whatever mess they create behind, and then go back home and tell everybody how great they are and, you know, all the great deeds they've done. But they're often leaving a huge mess behind, because they don't care who they're attacking. They're very much a kind of blunt instrument. And that actually leads to a bigger issue, which is the ability of people like the kings of Jerusalem to actually marshal the troops they've got, you know, because they've got effectively tourists coming in from the West who are very helpful, but, you know, slightly uncontrollable. But you've even got people like the military orders who report directly to the Pope, and they often behave like allies rather than, you know, a standing army. So they're sort of a standing army, but the king of Jerusalem has to be careful. You know, for instance, he has to persuade them to do things. He can't just say, you know, I want you there on Tuesday and I expect you to be doing this. You know, he really has to be a lot more careful than that. And similarly, you know, you find there's Italians in the cities doing whatever they're doing, but being very helpful. You find there are, you know, there's 20 different communities, all of which, to a greater or lesser extent, have to be persuaded to do things. So, again, huge admiration for the policymakers and the strategists in the Crusader states are continually juggling A, a huge lack of resources, but B, even the few resources they've got are not biddable in the way that, you know, a modern general would be able to bid his troops. So they're people who, you know, need to be cajoled into doing what's a sensible thing.
And again, it's that managing of different parties. You know, those tourists, those military orders, the Templars, who we did an interview about earlier last year, and your favourite, the Hospitallers. But then there's another party who I find quite interesting in this, and I think is often understudied and probably ignored within studies of the Crusades, which is the Egyptians. Now, often they worked with them or they worked against each other. How did the Crusaders seek to deal with and work with the Egyptians? Because you have this massive empire, which was formerly Ptolemaic, formerly Roman and Egyptian. So there's a massive military heritage there.
Also, probably more to the point, there's cash. I mean, it's the cash pumping station of the Middle East. The Nile goes up and down, irrigates a huge area of the valley. It's the most, certainly in those days, it was the most prosperous part of the world. And on the basis of that money, the Egyptians had, by the standards of the time, a huge professional army and a huge professional navy. So I think when the Crusaders came down originally, they knew the Turks were tough and they'd, you know, been fighting them a lot. But by the time they'd made their way down to Jerusalem, which actually had been part of was a Fatimid, was actually an Egyptian possession rather than a Turkic one for many years, they then just had a different enemy, you know, and this enemy was, with hindsight, we know that the Egyptian army wasn't as great as it could have been, but people didn't know that at the time. You know, it was huge. And it was very well equipped. I mean, they had proper industrial, you know, factories for making equipment. In some ways, they seem to have been more heavily armored and better equipped than the Crusaders. So Egypt was always a problem, particularly in the early years. The problem that the Egyptians had was one of the similar ones to the Crusaders, as in the population had been very largely demilitarized. So when you look at the Egyptian army, there's very few Egyptians in it. You know, the heavy cavalry tended to be Armenians, many of whom were Christians, actually, some Catholic, some Orthodox. And they were kind of proto-mercenaries, I guess. The leadership of Fatimid Egypt at the time was Armenian, ethnic Armenian anyway. So they just called for their mates and their second cousins to come down. And they were good heavy cavalry. The infantry were often from sub-Saharan Africa. So they would be either slaves who were sold by other Africans to the Egyptians. Some of them were supplied as tribute. There was a sort of very strong diplomatic links between the Fatimid Egyptians and the Christian Nubian states who did some slave trading and possibly provided some professional soldiers of their own. So it's slightly awkward, really. I mean, they got Turkic soldiers whenever they could, but if you see an Egyptian army in the field, it would be like, well, a small number of Turkic cavalry, large number of Armenian cavalry, lots of sub-Saharan Africans and some maybe Armenian infantry. And it's like, well, wow, where are the Egyptians in all this? And so you ended up with this kind of rather polyglot force that looked good on paper. It looked better on paper than it did in action, partly because they didn't really get on very well. You know, we find time after time, you know, the naval commanders didn't actually rate the army. The army thought the ships were a bit rubbish and they never came to help them on time. The cavalry didn't like the infantry. The infantry clearly didn't trust the cavalry, you know, and so it was very fractious. So it was one of those things where it could have been a lot more dangerous than it actually was. The trouble from the Crusaders' perspective was, you know, they spotted this because you couldn't avoid it, really. It's, you know, it's staring you in the face. The Egyptian army looks great, but actually isn't so powerful. But the Turkic forces discovered the same thing. So from particularly the 1150s onwards, there's a power play going on to see who's going to capture Egypt. The Crusaders obviously want it, and they invade, you know, under Baldwin and his brother Amalric. They invade multiple times in a very strategic way. You can see that, you know, as in there's a clear strategy unrolling. in front of them, and they're marshalling resources. They invade every year or every other year. I mean, it's kind of remorseless because they know it's the right thing to do and they haven't got any options, really. But they're also, the Turks are doing that as well. So Turkic troops are invading. And so sometimes the Egyptians are fighting against the Crusaders. Sometimes they're allied with the Crusaders to keep the Turks out. And everybody wants Egypt's money. And the other key thing to remember is that Egypt at this time was a Shiite state. And again, you know, nothing in the Crusades is as simple and as homogenous as you might think. So although the Egyptians were ostensibly Muslim, or large numbers of them were, they tended to be Shiite Muslim, or certainly the leadership was Shiite Muslim, whereas the Turkic states tended to be Sunni, even though large parts of their population were, you know, Shiite and different brands of different sects and so on. So there was always this kind of fault line. So you end up with this kind of three-way playground kind of fight, fist fight going on for pretty much over a decade. And the Crusaders lose that fight. I think they have the correct strategy. You know, they see the importance of Egypt, they see what they need to do, and by and large, they do the right things. But we come back to the usual problem, which is they don't have enough, you know, boots on the ground. And every time they look like they're doing, you know, they're going to take over Egypt, they can go in there, but they actually haven't got the manpower to hold it down. Whereas Saladin and his uncle, Shirka, do manage to take it over. Nur al-Din, you know, is pumping resources into the capture of Egypt. And that's really the major turning point for the Crusaders, because at that point, their strategic options are so limited. Once you find Saladin in charge of Egypt, he's not only surrounded the Crusader states, you know, because you've got Egypt to the south, and then you've got effectively Syria and up into Mesopotamia, all under the same empire, really, his Ayyubid empire. But he's also got the two magic things, which is men and money. You know, he's got men coming from the steppes. He's got, you know, so he's got the world's best light cavalry pouring into the region from the north. And he's also got the world's, or well, certainly the Eastern Mediterranean's biggest kind of, you know, treasury, spewing money out from the Nile because it's so prosperous. So he's got Egypt's money, and he's got Syria's manpower. And yeah, that's a kind of killer blow to the Crusades.
And you can see that divergence in strategy, where the Crusaders see what they need to do to survive, but they don't have the resources. And possibly the Europeans coming in while saying, well, we need to protect the Holy Land. That's our strategy. How do we do that? And there's a lack of aligning on their views.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the other key thing is having tourists is not, you know, if you're trying to defend a country, you need a standing army, really. You know, having people wandering in every couple of years and then going home when they feel like it, that's no way to run an army, really. So the kings of Jerusalem are permanently juggling, you know, thinking, oh my God, how many troops am I going to have in 2 years' time? I have no idea. And even the guys, if they do turn up in 2 years' time, they might go home the year after. And the king of Jerusalem can't command them, really. He can persuade and he can cajole, but ultimately it's a nightmare job from a military perspective. You can have clarity about strategy, but your means to implement that strategy are so fragile and so limited. That's one of the things I admire about them, is their tenacity in the face of such appalling choices and appalling, you know, problems that they're facing, and they still manage to, you know, struggle on for as long as they did.
So on that point, you know, the tenacity to continue when it all seems inevitable, when the fall of the Crusader states is on the horizon, they can see it, what strategies do they start to employ to try and prevent that? Because there is a very clear point of where it is abundantly clear.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, Saladin is the key. You know, he's an astute operator, and he's got resources that the Crusaders can only dream of, and a geopolitical position that's, you know, so much superior to theirs. So you're absolutely right. You know, the kind of the writing's on the wall, and the strategy that they come up with is a very defensive strategy, but ultimately it's the only option they've got left at this point. So they, you know, they can't. Egypt's gone. They've got no chance of recapturing any of the, you know, the inland areas. So they really have to hunker down and defend what they've got. And they do. The strategy is lovely. Even within those limited choices that they've got, they choose, you know, it's a kind of, it's a menu of different things they do. The most obvious one, because it's very visual and a lot of it is still there, is castles. You know, and you can see there's this huge rise in sophisticated castles, where you go from, and this is an oversimplification, but I think it's nonetheless true. So you go from small, very simple castles, like, you know, things you and I might have built at the beach when we had our buckets and spades out when we were kids, and they become much multi-layered, much bigger. So the walls get bigger, and the walls don't just get bigger and higher, they get more of them, you know. So you get the development of the concentric castle, where you get these different layers of walls. So when people break through one layer of walls, they haven't won. All they've done is they've just created a new problem, because they've then got more walls for them to go over. So this gives you survivability. So if you've got a crusader unit of 100 men, say, if you're in a village, you know, and a Turkic cavalry army comes by, you're dead within, you know, you're not going to see the hour out, 20 minutes probably. If you're in a castle, some of the crusader castles after the army was destroyed at Hattin, you find there, you know, handfuls of men held out up to 18 months or 2 years, you know, if you've got a really first-rate castle. And some of the guys were only surrendering because they ran out of salt. You know, literally they were dying. You know, they'd gone blind because of lack of salt. But the castles themselves still weren't captured at that point, and they could hold out for up to 2 years, waiting for reinforcements that never arrived. So that was one part of the strategy, is improve the basic infrastructure of survivability. The other things I did were try and get more money for mercenaries, get more equipment so that the local militia could be armed more, and improve tactics, you know, so they had more of the higher quality troops, like the Hospitallers and the Templars and so on, which is all fine up to a point. And the irony, of course, is if you read the Chronicles, you think, oh, maybe things weren't so bad. You know, the army that got destroyed at Hattin was probably the biggest army the Crusaders ever had. But you can see the desperation in that army, because basically, you know, there were still only a small number of knights, so that the Crusader heavy cavalry at Hattin were outnumbered something like 10 or 12 to 1 by Saladin's heavy cavalry. The Crusader numbers were artificially raised because they had a lot of shopkeepers there who were carrying a cheap crossbow, or, you know, carrying a sword that they'd, or a spear that they'd been given the week before. You know, and you find these are people who have very limited military capability. So it looks, again, a bit like the Egyptian army. It looks great on paper, but you actually get them in a battle and you find out what they're really capable of. So ultimately, though, as a strategist, it's very hard to see what else they could do. You know, so they're building the castles, they're revamping their own army as far as they can, they're scraping the barrel, they're sending a permanent series of begging letters to the West saying, you know, come on, lads, we really need your help. But the trouble is, until it all goes pear-shaped, it's very difficult to persuade people that your need is genuinely that great. And the other thing, I suspect, is hard to prove conclusively, but, you know, there's this whole thing about putting good money after bad, you know, and if you're in the West and you look at the state of the Crusader states and you think, okay, I can send them a load of money, but is it really going to make a difference? Are we going to win out there? And I think over time, you know, it becomes more difficult to do fundraising and to persuade people to come and settle out there. You know, back in the day, you could actually persuade people to come and bring their families and create a new life out there and be genuine colonists. It's increasingly difficult to do that because people love their families. They don't want them to be, you know, killed and overrun by, you know, cavalry armies. So, you know, the motivation for people to do that is less and less. So, again, it comes back to the thing we were talking about earlier, really. You know, nice strategy. Shame that you haven't got any resources, really. But in fairness to the guys, A, they haven't got a lot of other options. And B, they did actually create an element of survivability that, you know, I personally wouldn't have given them credit for, you know.
I think it's admirable how some of them were able to hold on for 2 years, despite knowing that nothing's coming to save them. And that the army on the other side of the walls is much, much greater than they can even muster within what's inside their castle.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you try and put yourself in their heads, I actually find it quite difficult to do in some ways. So you get castles like Karak and places like that, where, you know, their commander has been personally executed as a prisoner by Saladin. They must have known that help wasn't on its way. You know, there is no relieving army because there is no army. All their comrades are, you know, in prison or dead or sold into slavery. And yet they still carry on fighting. And I think there's, yeah, it is admirable, regardless of, you know, the good or rights or wrong of the situation. There's, you can see there's kind of bloody-mindedness coming in. They just really, that these are tough people who are not going to give in, or not going to, they're not going to die without a fight.
I think it's a really, really nice story to tell. But in terms of hunkering down, I have a final fun question for you, Steve. Now, in the foreword of your book, you mentioned how you were pub hopping across East Anglia. Now, I've grown up in East Anglia, the East Mids. We've got an awful lot of great pubs. So which was the best pub and why?
Yeah, that's the, see, there we go. That's kind of hunkering down I can do. I wouldn't be any use in a Crusader garrison, but I can do East Anglian hostel res. And it's indicative that I can't remember many names. So I have this blur of very, very nice timbered buildings with very, very nice staff and good quality alcohol. But the real reason I was there, and the thing that makes it all so much fun, made it stand out, was I was normally doing it with Malcolm Barber, who's a professor, who's an absolutely lovely man, who really was a lot of help in doing this. And he wrote a fabulous book called The Crusader States, which, you know, I think should be required reading for everybody. It's it's just a very well-grounded, hugely sensible, almost like a paradigm of what a good academic book should be, that is still readable by, you know, normal people. So yeah, good, hats off to dear Malcolm. He's a Brentford fan, like my late dad. So we used to, we still have nice chats and go around East Anglia. Sort of had lunch with him about 3 weeks ago up in Bury St Edmunds, and very, very nice it is too.
Oh, awesome. And it sounds like a great research trip, that does. So that's what, so obviously people listen to just a snippet of the Crusader strategy. They've listened to Crusader Army. They know where to get Crusader armies. But how can people grab a copy of the Crusader strategy, Defending the Holy Land? And then how can they, once again, interact with you, Steve?
Well, it's the usual sources. Local bookshops, always lovely. Great service. Amazon, I've got an author page on Amazon, and they have all my books there. It's published by Yale, and they have a very good site, which I really recommend as well. So, as they say, all good bookshops.
Fantastic. And I'll make sure, as always, a link for your book is in the description below, so people can go and grab a copy and learn more about these understudied areas of the Crusades. So thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Jackson. Always a real pleasure talking to you. Always enjoy it.
So thank you very much for listening to this amazing episode in this two-part series with Steve Tibble, all about the Crusader states, their strategy, and their armies. Now, I really enjoyed working with Steve on this, as I'm sure you could tell. Now, if you enjoyed this episode and this series and any of the other content that we create here at History Jackson, be that the blog or our social media content, please do consider heading to the Buy Me a Coffee profile in the description below, or heading to History with Jackson Plus on Apple Podcasts to help support the platform.